I will call this meeting of the Children and Families Committee to order. We've got a good amount of people today, so I will remind people that any audible demonstration from the audience is not appropriate, whether for or against any bill, and that we will treat everyone on the committee and in this room with the utmost respect at all times. But first, we will go. Representative Nelson, can I get a motion on the minutes?
Yes, I would approve the minutes from the March, I believe, 26th, 25th meeting. I would move them.
Any discussions on the minutes? The March 26th does not sound right. April, on the April 8th minutes.
Correct. I was reading the wrong, I did read the minutes, I was just reading the wrong line, so.
Okay. There we go. So seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. And I am really smacking this gavel hard today. All right. First on the agenda is House File 4407, Representative Don Gilman. Great to see you today.
Good
Representative
afternoon.
Gilman,
thank you.
If you would introduce your bill, and I believe we also have an author's A1 amendment.
Yes.
I will move the A1 amendment to House File 4407. Would you like to briefly mention what the amendment does?
All right. Thank you for letting me get settled here. I actually would love to ask, if nonpartisan would want to walk us through the author's amendment, that'd be wonderful.
Thank Ms. Sunderman.
Mr. Chair and members, the A1 modifies the bill to include most of the language from the DE1 that is also included in your packets, which incorporates changes to Representative Ogbaje's bill that were made in the Senate. So it just get the documents together here. It modifies the definition of disproportionately represented child and requires the Commissioner of Children, Youth, and Families to make that determination of who is a disproportionately represented child. It adds a section accordingly about how the commissioner has to do that. It also modifies items in the safety plan to just cite to the statute for neglect. It makes a technical change to the termination of parental rights restrictions, just modifying a cross-reference. It also modifies the training requirements, and I believe this was from some stakeholders, just some updates as to who must be trained and some priorities for who must be trained. It also makes some corresponding changes because the definition of disproportionality has been removed, so it makes a lot of technical changes to conform with that removal. And it also updates terminology in some places from child welfare to child protection, where it makes sense to do so. And it provides an expiration date for the working group for December 31st, 2027, which takes it out to the date in the bill for statewide implementation, the delay in the underlying bill. And it adds an appropriations section to appropriate money from the general fund to the commissioner to distribute to responsible social services agencies for support in implementing the act statewide.
Thank you, Ms. Sunderman. Representative Gilman, do you have anything to discuss on the amendment prior to the vote?
Thank you so much. This amendment comes as I am also a co-author on House File, I believe it's 4125, Esther Agbaje's bill. And we are also, as this has been working through both bodies, wanting to incorporate things that are very workable and good for children and families in the state of Minnesota. I encourage your support.
Any discussion to the A1 author's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Gilman, to your bill, now that's in the shape you would like.
Thank you so much. So thank you again for the opportunity to present this bill today. I want to start by being very clear about something. This bill is not about dismantling the Minnesota African American Family Preservation Act. The goals of the law, keeping families together, addressing disproportionality, and improving outcomes for children are important. We share those goals. What this bill does is acknowledge a reality that many stakeholders across the system have raised, often quietly. The law, as currently written, has a significant operational, legal, and fiscal issues that must be addressed before it takes effect statewide January 1st of 2027. There's broad agreement here that fixes are needed. And I've heard from this not only from counties, but caseworkers, legal professionals, and advocates. And even talking with the commissioner and folks today at DCYF, again, there are many concerns. But there's also a real hesitation to say that publicly because of how sensitive the issue is. That hesitation does not make the problems any less real, but it makes them harder to solve. Over the past year, I have been working continuously since we've left session with stakeholders to identify those issues and find a responsible path forward. That work has been ongoing and in good faith. Unfortunately, we've not seen that meaningful engagement from the other side of the aisle to come to the table and work through these concerns collaboratively. This bill is an attempt to move that process forward. There are several components of this bill before you. But here are some of the bigger pieces of the bill. First, the bill delays the effective date by 1 year. This is not to slow any progress, but to prevent unintended consequences and support the people who are on the ground doing the hard work. We already know portions of the original phase-in were found unconstitutional. Moving forward without resolving outstanding issues invites further litigation and instability in the system. The additional time allows the work group to complete its work, provide the legislature an important opportunity to review the recommendation and ensure implementation is thoughtful rather than rushed. And that's what, you know, our body did 2 years ago. We talk about this being a bipartisan law. That is what the Republicans said yes to. We said yes to the working group figuring out what the recommendations were going to be and what the implementation process was going to look like. To be clear, this delay does not stop counties who are already implementing the act from continuing to do so. Secondly, and critically, this bill addresses the fiscal reality facing counties. As written, the law imposes significant new responsibilities around case reviews without providing the resources to carry them out. That is the definition of an unfunded mandate. While we all agree that we need to support counties, there's not yet an agreement on how much support we should give our counties. Counties have been clear they are not in a position to absorb these costs. Without changes, we are looking at double-digit levies, increases, or cuts to essential services, especially in rural parts of our state. They don't get the same amount of funding as the metro counties do. This bill also provides solutions by having the department take on 100% of case reviews, paired with the time and resources necessary to do so. If this is a state priority, and I believe it is, then it should be funded and administered at the state level. Third, this bill implements safety measures around the most dangerous substances to hit our communities. Synthetic opioids. This committee talked about this issue earlier this session, and the question was posed, are any synthetic opioids in the home grounds for removal? And the answer is yes. If we're going to raise the standards for removal and require increased court oversight of the length of the validity of removal, then we are obligated to create guardrails to protect our most vulnerable population as well, our children. Members, the worst outcomes here could be implementing this law that is not ready, one that creates confusion for caseworkers, instability for our children, and financial strain for our counties. That does not serve the families this policy intended to help. This bill is about making sure we meet the moment responsibly. It preserves the intent of the original act while addressing the very real concerns that have been raised by those on the ground. I respectfully ask your support so much, and I'd love to turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. I neglected to move the wonderful bill, so I will move House File 4407 to be referred to Ways and Means, and then I will move the A1 amendment again to House File 4407. So all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment prevails yet again, and the amendment is actually adopted. All right. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair West, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of Minnesota Rural Counties. My name is Steve Schmidt, and I serve as Meeker County Commissioner and Vice Chair of Minnesota Rural Counties, or MRC. MRC recognizes the urgent need to address disproportionality in Minnesota's child welfare system and to support implementation of the Minnesota African American Family Preservation and Child Welfare Disproportionality Act. However, successful implementation depends on county capacity, both in staffing and in clearly defined responsibilities. MRC supports House File 4407 as amended. The bill provides much needed resources to counties and shifts certain case review responsibilities to the state, helping to relieve ongoing staffing pressures at county level. This is important, members, because the state doesn't fully assist counties with the cost of child welfare system right now, leaving a good portion of those costs to be financed via local property taxes. And as each of you know, not every tax base is created equally. Together, the changes in both Representative Gilman and Representative Akbaje's bills will better position counties to meet the Act's requirements. If the state is unable to provide counties with dependable, ongoing funding to carry out the functions of this Act, we would ask the legislature to push statewide implementation out. This would allow time to respond to the working group's forthcoming recommendations and incorporate them into training and implementation and have conversations about the reality and timeline of moving case review functions to the state. In Meeker County, we have been a leader in the area of child disproportionality, a process that has been 7 years in the making, starting back in 2019. Meeker's attention focuses on the child and the family first, knowing positive outcomes in the home bring benefits to everyone throughout the communities we serve. Although we find ourselves in a unique situation of leading in this arena, we also recognize the time, training, and lack of digital resources that continue to burden that process and its success, emphasizing the need to address technology modernization ahead of full implementation as well. We further realize from experience that most other rural counties haven't been able to establish their footing in this area and will face implementation challenges for years to come. Meeker County supports thoughtful and timely implementation to ensure success for all counties. Thank you to Representative Akbaje and Representative Gilman for your leadership. We know this issue is both critical and still includes some disagreements, but we are hopeful and supportive of both of your continued collaboration to ensure this act is successful, and I thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jenny Mojo, and I'm a Clay County Commissioner, and I'm here today before you to provide testimony in support of House File 4407, authored by Representative Gilman. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I really do want to acknowledge the importance and the intent behind the act. There are disparities in our child welfare system, and those are very real, and they require thoughtful, committed action. Honestly, I've had far more remarks prepared for today, but both Representative Gilman and Commissioner Schmidt really hit the high points, and they're very important, but it comes down to two pieces. One, counties want to succeed at implementing the act. It is important, and we want the expectations of what you have for our outcomes to be matched by the capacities in which we can deliver them. Secondly, that is, if the legislature is unable to fund that support and make changes, like moving case review to the state, then we should also be honest about what we are really expecting county outcomes to be and talk about a delay. My greatest concern is that if we move forward without the right supports in place, we risk unintentionally harming the very families in which this act is supposed to help. Regardless of how uncomfortable or tough this issue is for the committee and, frankly, the legislature, we are fortunate to have two leaders in Representative Gilman and Representative Agbaji trying to chart a course to help support successful implementation. I'm appreciative of components of both bills, and I'm so desperately hopeful that these two leaders and this committee and the rest of your colleagues can help in working in the final weeks of session to help us be successful. Thank you for your leadership and your commitment to the Minnesota's children and our families. We owe this to all of them. It's what we all care about. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public here today that would like to testify on House File 4407? Seeing none, I will move to member discussion, and I will kick it off with a quick question for the counties up there. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
I'm a citizen. My name is Jody McCarthy. And I just have a question about the synthetic opioids being an avenue to take the children away. And I only say that because I worked with people for a long time that were on the methadone program. So there were programs in which our state bought into and have been using to help people get through their opioid addiction. So I think it might be something that we might want to think about because it's what we're using to help people get off of opioids. So we have to be careful. I mean, our wording always has to be, we have to be careful.
Thanks for your comment.
Thank Absolutely. You. That is exactly why we have committee hearings. This, in the language in here, is for non-prescribed synthetic opioids because obviously that would be an overstep. And it's a rebuttable presumption if there is some other reason that is there is an ability to contest it. Representative Gilman, do you have anything?
Oh, I thank her for her comments as well. And again, I feel like you hit all the points that we need to talk about that. Thank you.
All right. To the counties, and this is also a question I'd have for the department, is one of the biggest issues that has been brought up is active efforts. What does that mean precisely? So as counties would be required to administer this, how do you see the definition of active efforts here, and how do you know when an active effort has been achieved? Whoever, unless there's just shrugging of shoulders, then we can see what the department has to say. Go ahead.
Chair, thank you for the question. I apologize. I don't feel like I'm educated enough to answer that. My social service director is likely watching this, trying to coach me through it. So I apologize. I'm not sure if I could divert to someone else, but
it's fine. Representative Gilman.
I'd like to comment on that. So with our bill here, It generally does not have an answer. There's not an answer for what active efforts actually means and when do active efforts end? Those things are not clearly defined, and that's what I've been getting as feedback from our counties, the people that are doing the work, is they need more clarity on this. And again, in other states where they have done family first acts that have come forward, those are things that have had to come back to the drawing board and to the table, and they wish they would have had more clarity on what is active efforts.
And we have somebody from the department here.
Oh, wonderful.
Could make.
Hey.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman. Rebecca St. George, I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Child Safety and Permanency at DCYF. And you are correct, there is not an absolute definition of it. It tends to be a case-by-case basis that it becomes up to the courts to help define for each case. It doesn't mean that a case can go on forever. That's still, there's still limits within the law around that. And again, depending on each case and what the judges are determining.
Ms. St. George, the limits, what is being proposed currently within the limits? What's the limit right now as the law stands?
I don't know the details of that, but this doesn't change necessarily. Active efforts doesn't change necessarily how long a case goes on. It just changes the kind of support. Primarily, it's the kind of support that's required to help a family.
Okay. But we won't know what kind of support that is until it's litigated? Or when would the courts be defining this? Ms. St. George.
Thank you. The social workers who are working with it, right, they work with the families to determine what they need and how they can best support them. That goes a little bit beyond reasonable. And so that happens first, working with the social service agency. And it is not super defined, I want to admit that. But it is something that each case is going to be different by definition, because each family is different. And so if it ends up in the courts with a judge needing to make a determine whether or not it counts as active efforts, whether they went above and beyond the reasonable efforts, that's when that becomes absolutely defined at that point.
Okay. Thank you. We'll go to Representative Sensimura.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is something that we've talked about in the committee before. So first of all, thank you, Representative Gilman, for bringing this bill and for the work that I know that you've done around this issue. So I believe that when we heard Representative Abaje's bill, I think kind of on your behalf, Representative Nelson brought something similar to lines 4.20 to 4.22 around the I think it had a little different wording, but the synthetic opioid. Mm-hmm. So my question is the same one that I asked last time, which is that, we heard, I think, last session in committee, Representative Knudsen brought a bill that I believe we did pass around increasing penalties for fentanyl use around, I think, children. I'm wondering maybe if Nonpartisan can speak to kind of what is the current law, and then what is this adding or changing?
Ms. Sunderman.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe there is a crime in Chapter 152 that is the use of fentanyl or methamphetamine around children or vulnerable adults, and it prohibits contact. But given that this is a criminal statute, I'm not an expert on this one, and I haven't compared the language. But I can get a comparison to the committee if that would be helpful.
To this question? Yeah. Representative Nelson.
Thank you for that. And I believe we had a little bit of this dialogue a couple weeks ago. And, I think one of the challenges of it, when there's synthetic opioids in the home it doesn't really matter whose they are. It is still a risk to, you know, I think as the criminal statute that was listed there, you know, it's vulnerable adults and children. And I think, you know, that is still kind of the same, you know, the idea of this here is that, you know, around children, it is still a danger regardless of whose they are.
Representative Sensenbrenner.
Thank you. Yeah, and I'm not, you know, arguing against that. I guess just the language that I see is no person may knowingly cause or permit a child to be exposed to or have contact with fentanyl, right? And so I guess it feels like we already have laws that protect this, and then I'm wondering, you know, if we are trying to just address the bigger, because I know that when we talked about Knudsen's bill, we were kind of talking about abroad, not just in the home, right? And I remember talked about, like, people have used fentanyl on the light rail, and so what does it mean if someone takes their child on the light rail and then someone is doing fentanyl, right? So that was a more broad law that was addressing public spaces versus just the home. But I guess, Representative Gilman, you know, why do you think that we need to specifically have this within the Minnesota African American Preservation Act versus if it is an issue about adults or parents mm-hmm. or guardians having, you know, having synthetic opioids in the home? Why are we not just doing, you know, a bill to address that issue across all mm-hmm. communities? Thank you.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And again, what I'm looking at in this bill right now is because when I've done research and talked to other states that have implemented this, imminent harm needs to be addressed. And if 90% of our kids, again, these are kids with disabilities, religious minorities, black and brown kids, folks, you know, the 90% of CPS cases that are going to be involved with this law that is going to be happening, I want to address imminent harm. And again, if that's not specified, and it's not specified in the underlying law that's going to become law here, and I would love to do a bill for all kids. I mean, again, I put faith and confidence in our folks that are doing the work, that are looking for upstream measures to help folks with substance use disorder. But when I learned about 100 children, this is babies and kids, in the last 2 years in the state of Washington have died because of imminent harm due to synthetic opioids in the home. That's staggering. That's 100 kids that don't get to have Christmas and get to have, you know, an impact in the world. So for me, and I did talk to Representative Egbaje about this yesterday as well, and we did talk about where else could this, why couldn't we do this for an overall piece? I agree. This is a start. And if we can impact, again, this law is here that will only impact 90% of all CPS kids. I mean, this is the law that's going to be coming into effect. So why wouldn't have we done it for everyone? So I agree. Those are great questions. But I'm very passionate about it because some of the solutions they found in other states is like finding, you know, having a lockbox, doing education around when you get high, this is how you can be around your children safely so you don't kill them. And it's heartbreaking. I was really, really discouraged by hearing the data on children just because they live in another state and their laws aren't protecting those kids. So that's why I felt really passionate about bringing it in here.
Representative Sensenbrenner. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is kind of outlined with a question or a concern that I developed from my time in transportation. I've got a county that had been looking for a transportation engineer, a county engineer, for years. And the Department of Transportation requires you to have a county engineer. Now, what we're seeing is through this bill an increase in ratio, and they're going to have to hire a lot of staff. So the question is, what happens to the counties if they can't find individuals to take on this extra burden, this extra caseload, these increased ratios? What happens to the counties if they can't find them? Can the department jump in and assist? Or on top of that, Is there negative effects of what would happen if a county can't reach the obligations that they're being forced or asked to do, mandated to do by this bill? What happens to the counties in this instance? How will they be, will they be negatively affected?
Thank you. Sure. So the way the bill is written right now, there aren't any penalties directly for not being able to comply fully. They would probably receive more technical assistance from us. They could potentially end up in court situations where they get ruled against because they didn't comply with the law, the same as now. If something happens and a county doesn't do what they're supposed to do and it ends up in front of the court, it's up to the judge to decide what the how to handle that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think, I mean, that's a pretty wide shot group. You're saying we could provide potentially technical assistance, or the county might find themselves in court defending themselves in front of a judge. Like, that seems like a significant gap in the lines here. That shot pattern is not going to hit the target. So I think we need to do something here to focus on that instance.
Can I also comment to that? Thank you for that question. Again, the reason the delay, I have been passionate about bringing a delay, is because the working group gave us an interim report, and it's pretty significant. I don't know if you've all read it or not, but we've seen highlights on it. That working group has to give us a statewide rollout, a plan. We need to get training modules. We need to have information. Meeker County took, for example, and this is a rural county that actively pursued doing some things differently for the county that I live in. And it took them years to implement, to do training, to do all the things. And it's not just the folks that are working right here with the kids. You talk about the judicial system, it's going to be massive. Interpreting the law is a big thing, and there's so much gray area. So that's why that interim report was huge. And we needed the training modules and the schedule for the statewide implementation. So counties can be very clear on what the expectation is. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Gilman. I know you have a passion for SUD, and I know you have a passion particularly for youth with substance use disorder. We've had those conversations. We had one yesterday, in fact.
Yes, we did.
I'm really worried about the it's imminent harm and you can take kids if there's any synthetic opioid in the house. And it goes beyond just like your teenager has an addiction and they could take your other kids. I'm really worried about the foster care system right now. We have so few homes that will take teenagers. I gotta tell you, if my county called me and said, hey, we've got this kid who has been removed from their parents' home because they had opioids and we have imminent harm, so we've had to remove them and all of their siblings, and we've got a sibling group, will you take them? Mm-hmm. I'm going to say no, because if I take them and they sneak opioids into my house and I call my licensure to say, hey, kiddo's got opioids, they could take all my current children too. I know what you're trying to do, and I respect what you're trying to do, but as a foster parent, it's already hard to say yes to teens because of what could happen. You add this in, and I'm never taking a teenager who's ever had a hint of substance use disorder, because they'll take all my babies. They won't just take my foster kids. This language says they're going to take all my babies, my bio kids, my adopted kids, and the foster kids. Mm-hmm. I cannot get behind removing children because of a choice of another child in the home. And I also don't know where we're going to put the teens who are using then. I mean, you and I talked about the holes we have in juvenile substance use disorder. And so if we remove a child, if we move a whole family unit because the 16-year-old is deep in addiction, and we've removed the 16-year-old and the 14-year-old and the 12-year-old, and we tell the kids or we tell the parents through this work that they can't have their kids back until there's no longer imminent harm, but we can't find a placement for the 16-year-old in substance use disorder treatment because we don't have any placements for 16-year-olds who need substance use disorder treatment, but we can't find a foster home for that 16-year-old because no foster parent is going to take a 16-year-old who's got fentanyl if it means they're going to lose all their kids. Where are we putting them? Like,
Where do the kids go? I'm really concerned, and I understand, like, on a pure level where it's like, if there's fentanyl, it's bad. But substance use disorder doesn't work like that in teens, and we are so short facilities already. I don't know how we do this without ending up with a whole bunch of teenagers sleeping in county buildings.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just, again, say that what my bill does is have the presumption piece. So there are levers, there are avenues for people to have their day in court. And again, fentanyl is the most lethal than any substance out there. And if we were to take a little grain of sand, like salt here, and know that that could kill children, and it does kill children and adults, I am passionate about it, and I do believe that we will navigate and figure things out, just like other states across the nation have done that have put these provisions in their protections. So, and I'd love to work on it more and see what we can do with that, but I'm very passionate about this because looking at the data, all kids are deserving of safety.
Representative Hicks.
And I don't disagree with you, and I know your heart's in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
But where are we going to put the children who are the users? If they can't go to a foster home, because if they bring fentanyl into the home, the foster parent's going to lose all their kids. And they can't go to a substance use disorder treatment because we have wait times. I'll tell you where they'll end up, and I'll ask your county folks because I think they're going to know the answer. You'll send them out of state, and you'll pay for it with taxpayer property dollars, just like you do for kids with complex needs whose needs we can't meet in this state. And it will cost the county property tax holders millions and millions of dollars to send them out of state, and we will struggle to get them back. And I do want to sort of latch on to something you said about people will get their day in court. I don't know if you've ever been part of a foster care child welfare case in the state of Minnesota, but I have. Once you do an emergency removal, so we're taking a 16-year-old, in my vision, a 16-year-old, a 14-year-old, 12-year-old, we're telling the parents they can have the 14-year-old and the 12-year-old back because they've removed the 16-year-old from the home. We don't have anywhere to place the 16-year-old. When we are talking about a 16-year-old with substance use disorder and our reaction to what are we going to do about that is they'll have their day in court, I am concerned. Because if you have never parented a child with substance use disorder, you don't understand that you can do everything. You can take the phone. You can follow them to school. You can limit who they talk to. You can do all the things. But a teenager with substance use disorder will humble you to your core. And so if that teenager brings fentanyl in the house, you're going to remove all the siblings? You're going to put that whole family in child welfare? That's a child who's in need of services for sure. But that doesn't mean that we should take all those kids. Your heart is in the right place. I appreciate what you're trying to do. I'm happy to chat about it. I'd like to do some work to find a solution. But I don't care if it's in this act or in General 260. I am concerned about removing everybody's kids because a teenager is deep in addiction. I can't get past it. I'm sorry.
And to that, just briefly, in the example you cite of you doing the right thing and being like, well, this child has opioids in the home or something like that, voluntarily giving the information is definitely going to factor into the rebuttable part of this presumption. And also, we shouldn't, like, I don't think the idea of having we allow non-prescribed opioids in the house when I don't understand that. That's still a risk. If somebody's going through substance use disorder, there's better methods than allowing them access to the substance they are abusing illegally. There is a way around this within this bill. Representative Hicks, briefly, please.
Chair, I don't disagree that there's a way to solve it. What my concern is that subdivision one is emergency removal and placement prevented. This doesn't say if there's opioids in the home, we should open a child welfare case. This doesn't say if there's opioids in the home, we should provide children in need of services. This doesn't say that. This says If there is opioids in the home, the county must remove a child. Or should. And I'm really concerned about that. Because it is emergency removal and placement permitted. And it scares me.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My question is both to Ms. St. George and then to Mr. Schmidt from Meeker County. One of the counties my district is part of Meeker County, so I represent a portion of that. And I met with the Meeker County folks, the county commissioners, 2 years ago regarding this issue. So my question is, Mr. Schmidt, Meeker County has been working on this since around 2019. And implementing much of the active efforts already, and spent countless of hours and man hours and time to do just this, to make sure the kids are safe and put into a safe families and something that's very suitable and very accommodating. What if implementing this new law in less than a year, have you calculated the extra cost that it'll cost the county to implement this law?
Thank you, Chair. Representative McDonald, yes, Meeker County, our estimates are cost, and this is a county of 23,000 individuals, so I mean, we're not a high populated county. We estimate our annual cost to be $500,000 if we implement as it sits. I would make just one other comment. Just a few weeks ago, our HHS director and one of our lead supervisors in HHS sat here and testified to the work they do on with Representative Abaje. So, and now I sit here as a commissioner on 4407, and I think that conversation within a county that's been successful in the work that we've done, but it's taken us many years to get here. There's going to be we need to recognize that though that we believe that the work within this bill is valid and there's things that are going to bring great value to youth within our communities, and that's what we focus on is that outcome. But at the same time, we realize that we have struggled with resources and within the parameters of the law as it's written, we will struggle finding more resources. We're going to need more four more employees in that department, and they are hard to come by. So are we borrowing them people from Wright County or from Kaneohe County or from others around us, and they're going to be in the same boat. So the challenges are real, but the value of 4125 is very valid too. I don't want to take anything away from that. But I want to also express the concerns of timing and getting it done in a proper manner.
Ms. St. George.
Thank you, Chair West. Are you asking if the state has calculated how much this could cost to the counties for implementing? Is that my understanding?
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, actually, I didn't. My question is yet to be asked by you, Ms. St. George.
Okay, I'll wait.
My
here.
Bad.
Yeah, that's all right, Mr. Chair. No worries. And the reason I asked that to the Meeker County, Mr. Schmidt, is because both Wright County and Meeker County have been doing this for a number of years and spent many hours, man hours, and tens of thousands of dollars to implement this very bill, the MAAFPA. And they're already doing this, and it's going to cost even more. But at this point, we're not ready for it. The costs are very, very large. It's too soon. We do need to put a pause. My question for you, Ms. St. George.
Just one quick question.
Oh, do you have a response?
Ms. Munger.
Thank you, Chair West. I would also like to provide insight in what Clay County's numbers are in regards to this. We are unfortunately looking at additional costs per case between $14,000 and $17,000. And in a time when counties are facing historic tax levy increases to help mitigate funds, we just are grappling with the staff capacity piece, but also the compliance piece. Counties do not want to be out of compliance with this. And unfortunately, given the fact that January is short 8 months away, we will be out of compliance. And to answer from the department, you know, obviously there's some other mechanisms there, but we're just hoping that there would be some sort of delay so that we could more accurately address the additional cost burdens that will come with it.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was just the point I wanted to make out that I voted for this bill 2 years ago, thinking it was the best thing that we should to do, and it certainly had some good components to it. But a one-size-fits-all doesn't fit for all counties, especially the rural counties, especially the counties that I represent. So I'm down here fighting for them who are already doing what this bill intended to do 2 years ago. To the agencies, Ms. St. George, would you acknowledge that the Act will require increased staffing to the counties, which you've heard, to meet the active effort responsibilities? And if the legislature doesn't pass the funding to help support these efforts, are you confident that regardless of financial support from the legislature, that the counties are in a position to be successful in less than a year when this is implemented in January 1st of 2027?
Ms. St. George.
Thank you. I don't think I can speak to each of the counties and whether or not they'll all be ready. I think some will be. I can speak to the state's readiness for what we need to do, but no, I cannot say with confidence that all of the counties will be ready.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, they aren't ready, and that's why we need this bill to delay it. Not to mention some of the counties are ready and have been doing this already.
Yep.
You acknowledge that, Ms. St. George?
Ms. St. George.
Yes, I do.
So in your opinion, Mr. Chair, in your opinion, Ms. St. George, since the counties are doing this already successfully, my counties, Wright County and Meeker County, and many other counties, I'm sure, of my colleagues, that perhaps this bill is not necessary, the bill to take tack, not Representative Gilman's bill, but the MAAFA bill that's supposed to be enacted in 2027. Would you agree that since our counties, some counties are already doing this at a great cost to the taxpayers and successful, and even more importantly than money, the success of the children's lives and their health and well-being, and the families in which they are placed in, and successful in the communities, that this is not needed since they're doing it so well and so with great successes. Would you agree with me?
Commissioner St. George.
Thank you. The department does not take a position on that question.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we all know the right thing to do, and I would bet that the department would agree that if counties are already doing this at their expense and success, then this bill, the MAAFA, is not necessary for our counties. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have a DE1 amendment, so go ahead then. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for bringing this bill. I have been asking for weeks for this committee to reconsider some of the efforts that Representative Agbaje had brought before us, so I'm glad that we're getting a chance to talk about this again. My DE1 amendment would align the bill with the Senate and would take into consideration all of Representative Agbaje's work without adding more into it. I do not agree that a delay is necessary. We have 2 out of 87 counties this session who have asked for it as of today. We have not a single time received a single letter from a single other county this year asking us for a delay. And I will side with my counties on that and side with the counties that have asked us pretty clearly what they want us to do. So my DE1 will get this bill back on track and will give us all a chance to vote for it. I think it's important that we know where we're at on this. I would like to ask for a roll call on the bill. And I hope that we can have the conversation about really respecting the work that Representative Agbaje has done. I did message her and asked her about your comments about the piece that Representative Hicks and Representative Sensenmiren brought up. And pretty clearly, she confirmed what I thought she would confirm, which is that she asked you to move that to a different section because it is more appropriately to be in a different section. That was the feedback that was given last committee when you joined us and when somebody else offered an amendment for, you know, to kind of get us to the same place. So I know you were here for that conversation. We also talked about it when you called me. And so I think what's important when we say that we're working as a team together, we can't sugarcoat what that means if it's not actually happening. Because if I take time to talk to you about something, right, as a subject matter expert on this, I would hope that then we kind of incorporate that as the bill moves forward, as the language evolves and as it changes. So I just want to be really clear about that, that over and over we have said that if that is the piece you want to pursue and that's so important to you, and I think you're hearing that it is very important to this committee as well, that that be in a different section. So I would like to have seen that somewhere else. And maybe I'm missing it. So humble me if you need to, but I don't think that it moved as far as I'm seeing. I think additionally, there's just some other, I can't go against 85 counties who are not asking for a delay. And so I think that's really important to say. I heard you make some comments that I want to comment on as well, but as far as for the DE1 right now, that's why I'm offering it, is to get this in the state that the broader team talking about this was on the same page with and kind of get us lined up back with the Senate again. Thank you.
For Representative Gilman.
Thank you. I would like to just clarify really quick. Steve Schmidt is here today testifying on behalf of MRC, and they are 45 counties strong. So they are in support of House File 4407, and they've been in support of the bill that I'm on with Esther, the 4125, again, stating that if the funding does not come through, this is why the delay is very important. Again, this is Minnesota rural counties that are asking for this, and there are, again, several other counties that would love to have been here to testify, but again, we've got 45 counties here today saying these are the things that they're looking for, and that's why this bill is before you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And what we would normally expect to see then is a letter before our committee, a letter from all 45, something saying that. But because in contrast, we've had a letter from organizations that represent all 87 counties that have not asked for a delay. So you're putting us in a kind of a tough position, right? If we don't have a letter to attest to that, I mean, it's tough to just take someone's word for it. We do want to see that, and that is the custom and usage, is that if that is the case, I would hope that, you know, the organizations that do represent all 87 counties and then the rural counties kind of reconcile that then before they get here. Because you're asking us to, like, take your word for it and pick a side, and that's tough, right? I think that is amiss, in my opinion, and so that's why, as far as we know and written information we've gotten, that's not been broadly supported. So
we'll move to a vote on this amendment as we have more people on the list for the general discussion of the bill. Go ahead. The clerk will take the roll.
Katiza Watoon?
Aye.
West?
No.
Hansen?
Aye.
Nelson?
No.
Altendorf?
No.
Coulter?
Aye.
Hicks?
Aye.
Lee?
Yes.
McDonald?
No.
Nadeau?
No.
Olson?
No.
Perez Vega?
That is Vega. Aye.
Sensimura?
Aye.
Zalesnikar?
No.
There being 7 ayes and 7 noes, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. I will go to Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. So today, you know, Representative Abaje's name has been mentioned a few times. But Representative Gilman, I know, you know, again, we all feel like your heart is in the right place here. But earlier you said that the other side, you know, you were kind of disappointed in that talks maybe didn't materialize. I'd like to ask if you could give some more information in terms of those conversations that you had, because Representative Abaje is not here, and she's not on the bill here with you, or your bill here.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and I'll just speak to that. I was scheduled to be co-presenting with Representative Abaje on House File 4125. Until the night before, because my amendment of a delay, there was an amendment that I was bringing because my concern was with looking at the working groups, what the working group is asking for in the interim report, IT modernization, more time and money, training modules were needed, scheduled for a statewide implementation. Those things were such a, and I was on the calls, at least a dozen of them, and talking with commissioners that are in Ramsey, Washington, different commissioners that are doing the work. So I was on that to be with her co-presenting, but because that delay word and the delay piece was in there until we had all the information, she respectfully removed me from co-presenting. That would have been my favorite. I could have been here with her to do that. And I love that I can continue to have conversations with her, but it was very painful for me to sit over here because I did have some answers because I was on those calls. And again, imminent harm, talking about synthetic opioids, that's another piece. Defining active efforts. Please give us an understanding. How can it go to case review issues then need to come back to the state? So judges, the cost that it's going to cost. I mean, we haven't even factored in how much the judicial system is going to have to spend per county deciphering what they should be getting involved in and not getting involved in. So I'll be honest. I am willing and able. I'll stay here till the morning to sit and hammer this out. I will do that because I care. And again, Republicans and Democrats, this should not be partisan, but it ended up being kind of a thing because of there was a disagreement on that delay piece. So
sure, yeah.
That's great.
Thank you. Thank you for
Representative
that explanation. Thank you, Chair. Sorry about that. It's really helpful. And of course, you know, I'm new. I'm getting to know everything. I'm also getting to know this situation and everything that, you know, is coming. It's been a long time, you know, working on it. But yeah, you know, of course, things are super hard right now. You know, Trump's budget cuts, a tight state budget heading into next year, counties already being stressed, even, you know, pre-COVID, right? Not enough resources, especially for rural counties.
That's why I think you would
Representative
really
Gilman.
Get behind. Thank you, Chair. I think that's why you should be a supporter of this bill,
yeah.
Because of those reasons.
However, I'm not. and here's why. I'm going to take us down a little path here that is controversial and a lot of people have a lot of feelings about. Black lives matter. Black lives matter. And Rep. Abaje is the black representative who's been working on this project with you and a lot of other people. And when I talked to her, she told me that this bill here, your bill, 4407, would not help her communities and her families. So for me, what that means is full stop. Full stop. Why did you move forward when Rep. Abaje opposed and didn't accept the delay? Representative Gilman.
Chair. Representative Gilman.
Can you repeat your question, please?
So you knew.
Representative Lee.
You knew that Representative Abaje was against the delay and your bill. So why was that not enough reason for you not to move forward with the delay?
Representative Gilman.
Again, thank you, Chair. As a legislator, when I hear it's the advocates, this is what I heard, is what would the advocates think if I sat at the same table as you, even to hear the amendment of a delay? And I just want to go back to, we are legislators. We do get feedback. We do get input from all of our stakeholders. That's how all these laws are coming to be, right? I am grateful to be able to work collaboratively, and I do love black and brown families quite a bit.
I'm sure.
And I don't know if you know much about my family, but I am a biological mom to two daughters and have three adopted children, two black sons and a biracial daughter. And if you ever want to see family pictures, I'd love to show you them, okay? So, no, this is not to harm black and brown families. This isn't just about black and brown families. This is about 90% of CPS cases in the entire state. And I do believe that we should apply efforts like this, you know, across the state. And I do believe social workers and all the people that are involved are doing those things. There are counties that want time. I am bringing the delay forward, and I've heard it's a non-starter. I've brought it forward again because the working group is asking for more time. They're not going to give us the report. I mean, by law, they're supposed to give us a report in September of this year. We will have a report in the interim saying, here's the training modules. Here's what we're going to do for our statewide rollout. This is all what we're going to do. We won't be in session. The law comes into effect in January. Will the rest of the counties that have not been funded, that have not proactively taken the work, done the training, will they be ready? And that's because I do care about the kids that are in CPS or that will go into CPS. That's why I'm saying a delay would be very vital and important so we get it right, so we extend the runway for good things to happen. It's not to hinder or prevent anything from happening. I'm nervous that if our legislature does not fund this and bring it back to the state, we are going to be begging for a delay. You're all going to be hearing from your counties, not just the counties. I don't want to see headlines of more kids being harmed. And again, this bill matches what the Senate is saying, what the bill that I'm on with Esther Igbaje is saying. There is a delay piece and there is imminent harm. I brought in a few other pieces, but this bill is really important. It's because I care.
Again,
so,
thank you.
Yeah, I would love you to see my family. I do care about families that are black and brown very much.
Sure.
Representative Lee, very quickly,
sure.
We're just going to go with the people on the list. Senator Murrah, Perez, Vega, Zalesnikar, and Hansen, and then close with the chair.
Sure. So. And, of course, I'm sure, you know, I'm not saying you don't care, but my point.
Hey,
no,
let's.
I didn't say that. No.
That's just,
I didn't
so,
say
okay.
That. I didn't say that. But Black Lives Matter. Rep. Igbaje is the black representative. I hope that you will continue to work with her. We are going to encourage both of you to continue working so we can try to find a solution here. Because of that, again, full stop, I won't support this bill.
Representative Sensenbrenner.
Thank you, Chair. I can make my comments quick. So this is just a little bit getting back to the piece about synthetic opioids. So we have this Safe Passage report about Minnesota child fatalities from maltreatment from 23 and 24. And when I'm looking at this, you know, I am seeing it's really, we should be really concerned about fentanyl use. You know, it says out of the 44 children that died from fatalities, 20% of them were exposed to fentanyl, right? Which when I kind of do the math, it's about 8 children. If I had more time, I would ask maybe someone from Safe Passages to come up, because when I'm reading through the report, I'm seeing a number of young people that also died through gun violence, right, through finding guns in their home and using them. Mm-hmm. So I guess agree with you that we should do something about fentanyl. I also think we should do something about loose weapons in the home. I'm a big supporter of the Safe and Secure Storage, you know, bill that we were not able to get passed. But I wonder, you know, just something to think about is if we're putting a rebuttable that word is hard to say. Presumption around risk for imminent risk for fentanyl. I would say let's do the same thing for loose firearms in the home. Thank you.
Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I just want to highlight that when we had the Association of Minnesota Counties, I met with so many of them on the day of the Hill, and I heard from their priorities. And I also heard, and I believe we had three county commissioners from three different counties amplify the support of Representative Bajay's bill. I don't hear much from counties prioritizing that this is damaging. What I'm hearing is that we need services that are equitable. And what your bill does in delaying is equitable services as to what the county is to provide, in particularly to black children and black families. The word delayed, it's like a punctured wound when we think about how delayed we are in human rights and how hard our country has fought for civil rights. Black people were delayed to have the right to vote. And black people were taken away from their country in chains, and in part, women pregnant. This isn't a myth. This is a part of American history. And according to, read my notes, the National Institutes of Health, black children mostly experience systemic delays in receiving crucial development, educational, and healthcare services compared to white peers. As a mom of a biracial, I'm Puerto Rican, I got every drop, and I was so proud to see this law going active. I got drops of blood from my ancestors of Borinquen, my ancestors of Africa, and my ancestors of European descent. And what's noticeably is that when you are of darker skin and the history of how our families have became Americans and citizens and residents, is that black children are always delayed. So when you have a bill that is, and Representative Lee, I feel your empathy, your compassion when we talk about black lives, because when it's laws that are amplified to create change for those that have not even been considered human beings in the Constitution, we had to change that. It took black people to change and white people to change it together. I'm not here for a body of Minnesotans to continue to delay on our black children. I have a black daughter too. I don't have the same understanding of what she's gone through because I don't have the same pigmentation of her skin. And she's already had to go through the racial disparities. I can't speak about it in the context that my own daughter and her grandmother and my grandfather has. I have a privilege. And as a representative with election certificate, I have a privilege to make change for the voices that are amplifying that we can't delay anymore on our communities. And we can't delay anymore on helping save our children in an environment that they deserve. I will not be supporting this.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. Again, this is a systematic delay that often happens when we're doing legislative things. If the word delay is a trigger, I would ask the body, I would ask the committee members to consider why. Why would I keep coming back to the table? AMC's top priority is to have case review and things go to the state. If all members of AMC could get on board with one thing or another, you know, two of those counties were funded. Taxpayers paid millions of dollars to not only those counties, but also to the state to implement this law coming into effect. I would never, again, be delaying safety, security, and a safe home for children. Again, 90% of all CPS cases are kids with disabilities, religious minorities, black and brown kids, and folks with experiencing poverty. So it's going to cover the bulk of all children, and I want to make sure it gets right. I don't want to be sitting at this table next year wishing that we would have done this bill. I know that there's opportunities to do this, and I want to have the investments that we made in the working group and the folks that are doing the work. And again, our state agencies are asking for more time and more money to implement along with the counties. So,
Representative Vega, briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, if we're focusing on such a delay, what I did hear from the Association of Minnesota Counties and from our Hennepin and Ramsey County Board of Commissioners was that there's a delay in the technology. There's a delay in the modernization of the actual technology that is to provide the data and also give these resources out. So I would like that we would be more supportive to the counties that are requesting to modernize the systems so that there isn't these leakages of fraud happening, yes, or that there isn't these leakages of outreach for those who need the benefits that the county is there to provide for. No more.
Thank you, Chair. I am 100% on board with that, and that is why IT modernization was one of their biggest requests in the working group along with the counties. And that is, again, why I want a longer runway so we can get it right. I appreciate that.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. What a conversation.
I love it.
I have so much to say because as someone who's been like really steeped in this work, I mean, the testimony has brought up so many questions. First, and we don't have to go through all of these, Chair, I know we're short on time, but I'm going to throw them out there. This discussion about active efforts, we don't know what it's defined as. Every single county in the state of Minnesota is fulfilling the requirements of ICWA. They absolutely know what active efforts mean. Absolutely. So I don't buy that. I think that if there's more conversation to be had, bringing a bill forward to change that definition without understanding the historical context and how huge of a national conversation that's been without even talking about that part really is not thorough. I think that when we talk about, you know, why we're even here, we're here because we had one of the most racist child protection systems in the country that we are working very hard to correct course on for years, that we are a home of boarding schools that separated children from their families and stole them from their culture and their community on purpose in order to assimilate them to something else as if assimilation was the gold standard. But what is the gold standard, what the real gold standard in Minnesota? We heard a lot of words about reality, and let's be honest, the reality is that this is the gold standard. The reality is that counties should have already been doing this for all of time. Lots of reasons why they haven't been. We can debate those. But in reality, that's what is in front of us. Everybody who's studied child welfare policy, you can talk to a number of different organizations. We know that making active efforts is a gold standard. ICWA's standards have been called gold standards. Like, this is not asking folks to do more. If I were at a county commission meeting, I would be asking my county commissioners, and I'm not in this case in my particulars, but for folks who are saying that they don't know what active efforts mean, what are you doing on ICWA cases? Are you just non-compliant with that? That's not, I mean, that can't be happening. I can't imagine any counties are willfully non-compliant with ICWA because there's federal consequences for that, right? And so if we're able to apply active efforts there, I think we should be able to do that here. I think the other thing we have to be honest about is that as we hear, you know, this conversation about money, there's a proposal I put forward that is supported broadly in both bodies that gave money. We were on the same page, you know, but because we're going back to this idea about working together, co-presenting, and that there was a concern about the word delay, what you call a concern, others call a deal breaker. What you call a concern, others call like a stall in negotiation. What you call a concern is what other people call insulting and hurtful. And I think that's real, and I want to recognize that. And, I mean, even in the conversations here, Representative Agbaje has done a lot of work to be really receptive. And I appreciate her for that, like the comments I made last time that when she was here. And so I guess if it's true that counties, there are allegedly some counties who won't be able to do this, number one, I'm curious, what are they doing on ICWA cases, and do we need to, like, open some kind of search on that? Because if that's alarming, if that's, people don't know what active efforts mean and they're not applying them there. And secondly, I would ask every county, would you rather keep the system as is or take the hard vote to raise your money to defeat this form of racism in your county? That's a real question. We hear all the time how folks, you know, come to the state talking to us about property taxes. We've talked about a lot of this, but we have to face the music on some of this, that taking votes to raise taxes sucks. I get it, especially in local and small government. But at what cost will you not take that vote? That's what I want folks to leave here today asking themselves. And Don, you said, why is it a trigger for some people? And I want to tell you, like, really honestly, the answer to that, because I think I hear you say that, and I think you are asking with genuine curiosity, because consider how many times the folks who are really passionate about this have been told to wait their turn. Mm-hmm. Right? How many generations? How many times? How many? Right? That's why it's not triggering just because people are sensitive or something. And that's not what's happening. It is hurtful to people because it sings to a longer song that's been sung in this country that some of us don't hear the same or experience the same because of the color of our skin. That's why it's triggering, right, you to use that word. And I would, rather than using that word, I think what you're trying to get at is that it's traumatizing. It's re-traumatizing people. It's reminding people of their difference. It's reminding people that while we say this country is all equal, you know, we're all created equal, people aren't treated that way. So please, when you think about it triggering people, can we just like reframe this and understand that when people respond that way, they're responding to trauma. That's what you're facing. That's what you're seeing in front of you. I hope that like folks will walk away from this conversation today understanding a few things. Like I said, active efforts are absolutely defined. They are absolutely clear. They may not be written in statute, but they are very common practice in every single county and nationally. Mm-hmm. That we are doing this because we have a history that we learned better from, and now we're trying to do better. And that counties absolutely do have it in them to raise their taxes to fund the things they need. Now, people may not like that. That's true. It hurts. It might affect your reelection. But at what cost do you not do it? When we know that this is the gold standard for how to do child welfare. Every research paper you can find will say that. So if we're going to be honest, we need to be honest about the unintentional harm that's already happening. You said, let's be honest. Let's be real here in reality. Well, let's be honest. There's unintentional harm happening that can't wait another year to be addressed. That's why this law passed. And I just don't think that we can keep saying that like a delay is just to like try to get some things done. When there are people and families affected by this, that when they hear delay, again, it is a traumatized reaction. Generational trauma, genetic trauma, situational trauma, environmental trauma. I mean, it's multifaceted. And to ignore that is to dehumanize people. To ignore that is to not recognize the dignity and worth of every single person. To ignore that and to ignore what's before us is to continue to repeat the harms of the past. So I really hope that we reconcile this in a different way, that when we talk about our colleagues, right, we talk about them in ways that are reflective, honestly, of the conversations that happened, and that we really, really stop ignoring the input of subject matter experts, because I'm not going to keep taking phone calls and to talk about this if we don't see an evolution of the language. I've not seen that. Adopting Representative Egbaje's language into your bill without addressing the things that you call a concern about, we call a deal breaker, right? Without doing that, like it is hard to take this work genuinely seriously. So I hope this is feedback you'll take with collegiality, I hope, because I've tried to say it a bunch of times when this has come up before, and at the end of the day, these are negotiations, and we do have to work together, and you can't just get, just say, I don't get my way, and so I'm disappointed. We have to keep coming back to the table over and over and over again, and the things that you are asking for have been things that have been brought up a lot of times, so that's all I have to say.
Chair Katiza Batum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Gilman, for all your work on this. I know that this is something that you are really passionate about, that you care deeply about, and I think, both in the initial discussion that we had about Representative Egbaje's bill when you were here in the room but not at the table, and then today here as well, people have really deep feelings about this issue, and I think that, the conversation does need to continue. We've got one shot tomorrow, hopefully, to pass a minibus out of this committee that will allow us to make some changes when it comes to this issue, when it comes to potentially childcare modernization, when it comes to some of the other priorities that have either no or low cost to the state. And I think that this issue should be a part of that conversation, and I hope that we can move forward on it. But I'm gonna follow my members' lead today and ask for a no vote. So.
Really quick, we're going to wrap this up now. To be clear to the audience, you can testify in the committee or you can write a letter. You can do both. We hear you. What's frustrating about this is we should move forward. We've heard that the department can't handle the cases, but we expect the counties to handle the cases somehow. We've been moving forward with a million questions, driving towards a cliff where we don't even have time for the report. So a delay is the responsible thing to do here, and we incorporate it as much as possible from all sides here. In particular, without IT modernization, we are going to have so many errors, and this is just going to be an unmitigated disaster because the county simply can't do the work. So my hope is that we could move forward with this because it is genuinely the only way forward if we want this bill to be successful. Otherwise, it's not going to work. And then there are no penalties, as is brought up, but there is plenty of litigation to open up. So county's already moving in this direction, which is a good thing. So the goals of the bill are being accomplished. Only two counties got funded, and of course they would enjoy that and would like to continue that, but it's going to cost all the counties money. So I would urge members to support the bill. Representative Gilman to close.
Thank you. Again, I would just like to say this bill is not about dismantling MAPSFA. The goal of the law is to keep families together, and I agree with that wholeheartedly. We need to continue this work, and we share common goals. And I appreciate when I do ask questions, I genuinely want to know. I'm looking for answers. It's not about I gotcha, or I'm having hurt feelings about not presenting on the other bill. I have respect for all members across the aisle, as well as my own colleagues here. I want to legislate well while I'm here. I'm representing my counties, but I'm representing the state. I want to show up with dignity and respect. And I hope that I would get that at the table here, too. And it seems unfortunate at times that we can have disagreements, but I'm excited for us to have more continued conversations around this. I do strongly encourage support for this and look forward to seeing movement forward on this. Thank you so much.
I will request a roll call on the bill and renew my motion to refer House File 4407 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Clerk will take the roll.
Katiza Witoon?
No.
West?
Aye.
Hansen?
No.
Nelson?
Aye.
Altendorf?
Yes.
Coulter?
No.
Hicks?
No.
Lee?
No.
McDonald?
Aye.
Nadeau?
Aye.
Olson? Perez Vega?
No.
Censor Mura?
No.
Zalesnikar?
Aye.
There being seven ayes and seven nays, the motion does not prevail. I will lay the bill over. Thank you for coming, Representative Gilman. Now move on to another very important issue, which is the modernization bill. So I will move House File 4382 before the committee. And we will move on to, do you want to give a very brief introduction so we can get to the testifiers, which starting with Ms. Holly Seville and Don Uribe. Brandy. Wait, which one?
Brandy.
And Brandy Srora Coons are the first couple. Go ahead, Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have 20 minutes to get through 120 pages of bill, 11 testifiers, and 6 amendments. Let's do it.
Let's focus on the testifiers.
No, I will be extremely brief. This is, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, the Child Care Regulation Modernization Bill. We had a hearing on this effort earlier this year, so I won't go into detail on that. I do just want to make two things clear before we move to testifiers. Number one, whatever we pay our nonpartisan staff, it is not enough. Our nonpartisan staff has done incredible work on this bill, summarizing or synthesizing all kinds of language and amendments from the Senate and all manner of other things to get us to where we are today. So I did just want to take a moment to thank our nonpartisan staff. And the second thing that I really just want to emphasize here is that the what we have before us when we adopt amendments and move this out of committee, that will not be the final language. I know there is still work to do. Some bills are big bills because they do one or two or three big things. Some bills are big bills because they do dozens and dozens of small things.
and this one is the latter. And so we have, there are just so many pieces on this bill that we have been working through. Some of them are reflected in the amendments that we probably won't get to talk about today. But I just want everyone in this room to know that I am continuing to work on this language. I have meetings tomorrow and next week trying to get to a place where we can get something that will work for folks. That's all I'm going to say because we have 11 testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Coulter, for being brief. All right, we will start with Holly's bill and then Ms. Rogan. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, Chair West and members of the committee. My name is Holly Sable, and I'm here as president of the Minnesota Association of Child Care Professionals. I've been a licensed family child care provider for 21 years. I've worked in schools, centers, and have been a trainer for early childhood and school-age professionals for the last 16 years. I'm here today on behalf of Minnesota's 5,400 remaining licensed family child care providers and the children and families we serve. Family child care is not a system. It's not an institution. It is someone's home. It is where babies are rocked to sleep, where toddlers learn to share, where preschoolers build character, where schoolagers learn independence, and where parents trust us with their most precious people in their lives. Right now, the outlook for family child care is very fragile. Minnesota has lost more than 6,500 licensed family child care providers in the last 15 years, more than half. That means fewer options, longer wait lists, and entire communities without care. This bill would make it worse. Not because providers oppose accountability, we don't, but this proposal goes far beyond health and safety and into subjective, unclear, and burdensome regulation that does not reflect how family child care actually works. And importantly, many of these requirements come without clear evidence that they will improve safety or outcomes for children. In real life, this looks like being required to follow outside directives that may not be safe in a group setting, undermining providers' ability to protect all children in their care. Costly structural mandates such as fencing yards, modifying basements, and redesigning play spaces, which many homes simply cannot accommodate. Vague standards like unpleasant odors or may pose a risk, which will be interpreted differently by licensors and counties. Increased paperwork, training, and compliance requirements that pull providers away from the children in their care. Expanding subjective enforcement, creating uncertainty, inconsistency, and risk for home-based small businesses. But here's the most concerning part. This bill will make providers think twice about staying open. And it will make some decide that it's no longer worth the risks or costs. Because when you increase liability, costs, and uncertainty all at once, providers close. And unfortunately, we've seen that happen. Even small regulatory increases over the years have contributed to the loss of thousands of providers across Minnesota, and this proposal risks accelerating that trend. When providers close, families lose access, parents can't work, children lose stable, relationship-based care, and costs go up, especially for infant care, where family child care is typically less than half the cost of centers. Since 2016, the legislature has formed committees and task force to address the mass exodus of licensed family child care providers, including the Legislative Task Force on Access to Affordable Child Care. The recurring theme in their reports to the legislature was that overregulation, burdensome paperwork, and licensing misinterpretations have exacerbated the loss of providers. In fact,
please
DHS presented this month.
So we can get
sorry.
To more. Go ahead.
Okay. We all want safe, high-quality care, but modernization has to be clear, workable, and sustainable. It has to protect children without pushing providers out of the profession. We're just asking you to pause and work with us. We've submitted a redline version of the original bill, and we encourage you to look at that and consider that, but pause and just let's not rush this through. Please reject this bill in its current form and work with providers to create solutions that protect children, preserve access, and keep family child care in Minnesota viable. Because once these providers close, they do not come back, and neither do the options that families depend on. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Okay. I am Dawn Uribe, and I'm the owner of Mis Amigos Preschool. And thank you for the opportunity today to speak and show my support for this bill. My reasons for showing support, I am a center, and so where she was representing home-based, a lot of the reasons that she opposed the bill are the reasons that I support it in terms of center care, center licensing, because this is reducing some of the things that she talked about that is increasing for family child care is actually decreasing for center. This bill is not perfect, nothing ever is, but the revised center standards give providers more flexibility, clearer guidance, and a system that actually weighs how serious a problem is instead of treating everything the same. And I want to share a story about why finishing this work this season really matters to me and my business. Recently, one of my programs got a couple of citations. The public record says hazardous objects were accessible to children. That sounds really scary. In this case, it was a play rug that had a small bit of a printed design that was peeling up. On a separate occasion, I've been cited with that same title for a package of diaper wipes that were left on a counter. Another one said children were subjected to prohibited disciplinary actions. That sounds really scary. In reality, it was a couple of babies who were buckled into their high chairs for a couple extra minutes while they waited for a diaper change, but they didn't have a toy on their tray. Those weren't perfect moments, and we retrained everyone on why it's important to meet those standards, but they're not the same as real safety failures, and our current system treats them like they are. That information is public, permanent, and has no explanation attached to it, and this affects my school in real ways. I don't know the number of parents who have seen that information and never called, and my insurance goes up every year. In 2024, it increased by 50%. A program doing great work and a program that generally isn't look exactly the same to a parent or an insurance carrier. Families deserve to know the difference. Providers who are doing right by kids should spend less time on licensing. Licensors should be able to spend more time on programs that are clearly not meeting the standards that matter most. If nothing passes this session, we are realistically...
Please wrap up your testimony.
Okay. We're realistically looking at July 2028 before anything changes. And that's two more years of hurting good providers while not focusing on the providers who need the most attention. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Brandy Siroga-Coons, and I'm the Executive Director of Creative Kids Academy with 13 metro locations. I am here testifying in support of moving forward with the center-based licensing modernization standards. I have worked in the childcare field for nearly 28 years, yet we are still operating under licensing rules that date back to the 1980s. To think that many of today's educators were not even born, it is clear that these outdated regulations no longer reflect current best practices or the realities of modern early childhood education. For example, licensing requirements still reference outdated equipment such as cassette or record players rather than aligning with today's technology and learning environments. Most importantly, some regulations conflict with current health and safety guidance. We are required to have two blankets per infant despite the back-to-sleep recommendations that advise against the use of blankets for children under 12 months. Situations like this highlight the urgent need to modernize licensing standards so that they are consistent with current research and safety recommendations. For these reasons, the licensing modernization draft must be passed now rather than delayed further. Although this draft is not perfect and needs a lot of work, it is better than the outdated rule we currently use. Even if passed, implementation is not expected until July 2027, meaning children and providers will continue operating under outdated rules for many more months to come. Passing the draft would also allow for the implementation of the weighted risk system, which more accurately reflects the severity of licensing violations. Currently, minor issues such as a toilet not being flushed are treated the same as serious hazards like bleach being accessible to children. A weighted system would provide clearer information to families and insurance providers about the risk level of care. Additionally, childcare providers are facing increasing challenges with insurance companies raising premiums or dropping coverage altogether. Updating licensing standards, implementing a risk-based system could help provide some much-needed relief and clarity within the industry. Modernizing childcare licensing is not just necessary, it is overdue. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We'll go Cindy Cunningham and then Amy Jo Van Cullen.
Good to be seen.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I am Cindy Cunningham, a licensed family child care provider, 30 years of experience in Ramsey County. You have my testimony, so I'm going to skip through the little comments, try to get to the gut of the situation. Many have heard me since November state that we wanted a collaborative bill which didn't need so many amendments. We don't have that. It's going to take amendments and more work at these tables. We appreciate everyone's engagement, both DCYF legislators and providers. This is hard work. What we have to do in front of us is a bill that's slightly better than previous drafts in some ways, such as increased infant toddlers, one stream of licenses, and inclusion of additional pets. Yes, that's an important one. What we also ended up getting was additional and intensified regulations, which have not come under public discussion until now. Hence, some of the discussion difference between centers and us. Centers got less, we got more. And in particular, what was added intensified for family child care came after all public discussion. It came after the move to the new department and new staff and has not been under any provider input until our amendments, our discussions in this presentation. They have primarily focused, excuse me, again, this has not been on providers' discussions. I'm going to go through a few of the complicated and more inflammatory, possibly, amendments that we presented in the Senate that unfortunately did not come over here. Ratios, the increased, yes, infant toddlers is good. However, there is an exclusion of the B1 ratios. There's a perception that it isn't needed. It is needed. B2 ratios are now in the C1. People who functioned at the B, if anybody wants to go nuts, it's ratios. The B1 ratios are obliterated. B2 licensed people used to be able to or currently can run at the B1 license. To get rid of the B1 license is not taking into account how many are using that. The firearms, we share the concern about children's safety around firearms. We know this has been a strong discussion for good reason. Our proposal changes how we communicate with families, but does not lessen these concerns. It protects privacy while encouraging safe storage discussions. High percentage of children involved firearm incidents takes place within the home, not in the care setting. The bill proposes that we include the acknowledgement of an existence of firearms in our homes, in our settings, to be in our policies, and that bill also states that we have to make our policies available electronically or written upon request. That means if I put in my policies that I have firearms in my setting and someone requests, then I have now no control, no influence over what my privacy is. Theft of firearms is a strong use. That's the biggest problem that people, it often doesn't get discussed. What we're suggesting is to put in to put into our policies what the standard for storage is. We use our policies to discuss with our parents. This means that every family who comes into a provider's home is going to have some acknowledgement, some discussion about what safe storage is. We have families out there that don't know that. So at one point in time, they're going to have some discussion about safe storage. We see this as a stronger message than just a yes or no answer.
Please wrap up your testimony.
There's never. We ask to look at the provider's own children carefully. That is already in practice. We're not making it up. DHS had it in the draft too. The overnight proposal we have is broader and better based. The restraints have to be used. They go the bill that's here goes against what we're trained to do. If the bill doesn't pass, we do revert to current law and structure with that 9502 locked-in rule. The investment of time, effort, and money will be lost. No plan to move. However, should the bill be enacted in its current form without provider association and input, we will be losing providers. And at that point in time, Leading Care would not support the bill if it is put through without provider input.
Thank you. After the next testifier, Kylie Cooper. But Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, I am Amy Jo Van Kulin. I am an insurance consultant for Marsh McLennan Agency. It's a little different twist on this. I am testifying in support of center standards moving forward. I'm here to tell you that modernizing our licensing system is essential to supporting the sustainability of Minnesota's childcare industry, safeguarding our children's well-being, and strengthening our communities. Despite their importance, our standards for licensing have not been updated since the 1980s. We have technology to modernize and improve transparency, yet we continue to rely on vague, confusing reports and unfairly penalize providers. This modernization project was authorized by the legislature in 2021, and consideration of new standards was already punted from last session to now. It is imperative that we get this across the finish line. Currently, licensing reports contain vague or misleading language that can adversely affect insurance coverage. For example, citations such as areas used by children were not in good repair might refer to a single loose string in the carpet, an issue that poses no real safety risk, but could be misinterpreted by underwriters as a serious violation. Similarly, allegations labeled as maltreatment investigations, even when proven false, remain on reports and can lead to non-renewal or exclusion of insurance coverage for abuse and molestation allegations. These wording nuances impact the insurance market, often resulting in childcare providers being categorized as high risk and facing excessively expensive premiums or denial of coverage altogether. I have personally encountered providers in tears pleading for help to find affordable insurance, many whom never filed an insurance claim but are now penalized due to licensing report language. It is imperative that we prioritize the completion and implementation of the regulation modernization project. Updating licensing standards and inspection processes based on which violations constitute greater risk of harm to children just makes sense, and will help ensure that reports accurately reflect the safety and quality of childcare centers without punishing providers too greatly for minor or non-safety issues. Clearer, more precise language will enable insurers to better assess risk, leading to more affordable and accessible coverage options. In conclusion, modernizing our licensing system is essential to supporting the sustainability of Minnesota's childcare industry, safeguarding our children's well-being, and strengthening our communities. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. After Kylie Cooper, we'll go Amber Sadolsky.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Kylie Cooper. I'm a child care provider. In my years in the field, I have worked with the statewide QRIS, training implementation, the workforce registry, Head Start, and in nonprofit organizations. I'm also the mom to a vibrant preschooler. I'm here today to encourage scrutiny for House File 4382. While I'm heartened that there's widespread agreement and acknowledgement of the well overdue need for licensing rule reform and modernization, this bill falls short of delivering on that. We have a real opportunity to create a childcare ecosystem that's driven by research and centered in the needs and the rights of children, families, and educators. Consumers, the parents and children, deserve to know that the programs that they bring their children to are being held to high standards of care, health, and safety, and that critical brain development that happens in the first 5 years is being nurtured. In practice, licensing rule creates the bare minimum that a licensed childcare program can perform and supposedly provide the level of care that the state deems necessary. It's been shaped through years of investigations and worst-case scenarios, interpretations, and ingrained practices. Childcare providers deserve a licensing system implementation that's consistent, transparent, and supportive of their work with young children. While I feel that this bill as a whole is not ready for passage, I do highly recommend an amendment for the creation and the implementation of a board of early care and education. This board can be relied upon to incorporate relevant research, best practices, connect with the field directly, and represent a cross-section of the mixed delivery system that makes up this industry. Through collaboration across the sector and partnership with the state agencies, we can create a licensing system that our state deserves and continue to build on the reform work that's already ongoing. I look forward to continuing the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. We have, after this, after Amber, we have Martha Najolamo, and that likely will be all we can do today, but I assume tomorrow we will take more testimony. But go ahead. Introduce yourself for the record. Proceed.
Good evening, Chair West and members of the committee. My name is Amber Sidlowski. I am a provider in Orono. Sure. I will keep this short and brief to respect everyone's time while staying strong. I want to start by saying this. As a provider and knowing many other providers, we all want safe and high-quality child care for the families and children that we serve. The latest modernization draft, however, still reflects a system that is being built around providers, but not with providers. It does not change the system. It does not meaningfully reduce the incredible administrative burden on providers, nor provide support and resources for providers to meet the existing burdens. It does very little to modernize how we operate child care programs. Instead, it mostly repackages how we've been doing things for decades. It doesn't address the confusing, subjective language that continues to add layers of complexity to an already struggling system. Rules are not clear. Both licensors and providers have different interpretations, and the outcome doesn't reflect the quality of care that providers are delivering. I would like to express my strong support for a Minnesota Board of Early Care and Education, which would include experts in best practices for health, safety, and quality, as well as those impacted. That board would then have the necessary flexibility to adapt, change policies as best practices, and improve, and would be very grounded in what it would actually be happening in child care programs of all kinds across the entire state. Our child care licensing system doesn't need a tune-up. It needs an overhaul. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. We're going to go slightly over time. We have three testifiers on the list after this one. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Martin John Malay. I am an economist at the Center of the American Experiment, and for the last 4 years, I've written extensively on how Minnesota's child care affordability crisis impacts parents, children, and the entire state economy. So I am really glad that we're here today talking about doing some reform. I have provided in your handouts, you see a more detailed brief talking about why we need more comprehensive changes. So I will limit my testimony here to two major changes in this bill that I support. First, I support the proposal to reduce hiring requirements for center staff, including teachers and assistant teachers. Our child care centers in the state cannot find workers. In 2024, the DCYF had to issue 4,000 variances so that centers could hire workers that were not qualified. This means that there is a mismatch between state rules and the qualifications of the applicant pool that is unlikely to be addressed by increased funding. It also means that a lot of the centers that cannot apply for variances are operating below capacity. So we need to make these changes. Secondly, I support raising capacity limits for family child care and also making staff-child ratios more flexible. A lot of the previous testifiers have already mentioned this, but we are losing our family child care providers, and this has been really hard for Greater Minnesota, partly because it is harder to start a center there compared to the metro region. So those lost slots are not being replaced by centers. We need the existing family child care providers to be able to take care of more children. In recent years, we've also seen existing providers lose older children to publicly funded pre-K programs. This means that they're becoming much less viable than in the past. So if we allow them to take care of more younger kids, it means they can convert those open slots to increase space for the younger children, like infants and toddlers. There's a high demand for child care for that age group. Overall, I think that this is a good first step. I think there's more that can be done and should be done to reduce burdensome regulations on child care providers, but parts of this bill are a step in the right direction, so I support them. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. We will go to Caitlin Erpstad on Zoom. And quickly, is there anybody here who is not on the list who would like to testify? Okay, go ahead, Caitlin, please. you are muted still. Ms. Erbstad, you are muted. Or is that on our end? The output on our audio might be incorrect.
Yeah, we're. It's got the stuff.
It's the little green bar on the microphone.
Yeah. Click on the little audio arrow on the audio.
Oh, this is really hard to do.
Yeah. Click.
Oh, well, that just means us.
Well, can you get there? We want the menu up. Dun, 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 and then echo canceling speakerphone. Yeah, just select same as system right up there. Down, no, under speaker. And there we go. We'll just see if that works. All right. No dice. Well.
She's talking, we just can't.
Yeah. Yeah, I think somebody said she was on mute. Well, this is the classic Zoom debacle. It seems like she can hear us. Yes, sorry.
It's not me.
Well,
it wasn't me.
Can we ask if one of the other Zoom testifiers can talk?
Well, it's definitely on our. So sounds like they heard us say that, and Ms. Rosbrook attempted to speak. It's clearly an output issue on our end.
I don't.
So it sounds like something's not plugged in.
Oh, I'm not.
Well.
While we're waiting, if I could just, Mr. Just very, very,
Representative
very briefly.
Coulter, what did you do?
I touched nothing intentionally. I did just want to say, you all know, obviously, there are a number of amendments that I have brought forward. My commitment to all of you, most of you in this room have my number. I really had hoped we would be able to walk through them today. Please do reach out to me. If you don't have my number, you can get it just for the folks on the committee. Sorry. You can get it from somebody who does have it. My commitment is that I will bring home my folder tonight. I'm happy to talk with folks in advance of tomorrow. I will also say again that Ms. Filoni Day has been an excellent resource on putting these amendments together. She has lots of different ways of summarizing this information, so happy to talk through amendments with folks before we get to work on the amendments tomorrow.
Okay. Well, this is an unfortunate... What? Wait. The blue screen of death?
Maybe.
Ms. Erbstad, you want to? No. All right. Well, I think.
Mr. Chair, we will try to get Zoom set up for the testifiers who haven't been able to testify today at the start of tomorrow's hearing. We'll reach out.
Well, and with that rather haphazard and sad end, we will adjourn.
Well, kind of.